never work. People don't want war. It destroyed this planet, its people, and all records of past civilization.
Not all records, as you'll soon find out.
Attention! The time has come, as I promised. The time when I reveal to you, my loyal followers, the ancient secret of war. The key to creating hysteria, fear.
Prepare for wizardly combat.
I want to show you a trick Mother showed me when you weren't around.
And I'll not laugh for fast death, but don't yell in vain.
Welcome to Spellburn, a podcast covering the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game and old-school adventuring. It's time to party like it's 1974.
This week on Spellburn, we're going somewhere totally different. Over the last 45 episodes, we've talked about many different aspects of the game. The classes, the magic system, the mighty deeds, the monsters, and more. In this episode, we're going to talk about how people actually use the rules, and specifically how people abuse the rules. Specifically what players do to twist and break the game, and what judges might do to respond to those tactics. And we'll do it with an eye on the con games as well as the long-term campaigns. I'm Judge Julian, and with me are...
This is Judge Job.
And Judge Jed.
And welcome to Spellburn.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, guys.
All right, we will roll into some tavern talk.
And the first rule of bartending is this. GBTB. Go beyond the book. Go beyond the book.
What do you have? Heineken! F*** that
Tavern Talk.
I will start off by asking, what have we done in the past week, especially over the holiday season? I know many of us had family plans. I snuck a game in there. What did you guys do?
Insert awkward silence here. Got hit by a truck, apparently, on the family and holiday end, and so there was no gaming in the past week. I am
Oof.
Sad.
Oof. Judge Joe?
Yeah, more of the same. You know, did some writing, made some spreadsheets of trying to figure out different spell results and stuff like that. Working on Dying Earth. That's been my week or two in gaming. Yeah, hopefully in the new year I'm going to get it some real gaming in and not just talking about gaming.
That's a great resolution as we move into 2017. I actually played a completely random pickup game on Friday. I ran Alpha Blue by Venger Satanas, kind of off the cuff, very little preparation, and it was really fun. One of my friends here in the local G Plus group just said, hey, who's got a pickup game going? So we just got together and rolled some dice. It was actually really fun.
What is that game anyway? Isn't that like Blue Rose type of game or something?
It's kind of like Blue Rose, filtered through campy B movie, like raunchy B movies of the 70s sci-fi genre. It's kind of like NC-17
Barbarella.
Space. Yeah, I think Barbarella would be right in the vein. It's set in a giant brothel space station. It's a very open-ended, easy little dice system to use. It's very free form. So it's just a snap, and it's almost a little DCC-like in that it has a lot, it's very table-based. There's a lot of charts with fun results that, you know, sort of guide you through the narrative based on, you know, just the roll of the dice. We had a blast. It's great for a pickup game because there's so much that you determine as you make characters and stuff that the sort of the plot kind of writes itself based on people's, you know, the characters of backgrounds and fetishes and all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
Cool.
It's probably not a game you play with your kids.
Yeah, try me.
Well, I'm just saying.
Actually, it's kind of funny. I made this game called Fanfic a long time ago, like a story game.
Yeah.
So I had actually play tested it with my children. So I just play tested the mechanic. So we didn't, you know, we weren't making fanfic with my 7-year olds. We did kind of like a happy birthday robot type of thing with it. It's just pretty funny because people at the time, they're like, oh, well, this, you know, what's this game you have? And I would tell them about it. And they're like, oh, yeah, I play tested on my kids. And they're like, what?
Anyway. Well, Venger games with his kids a little bit, I think, but probably not that one.
Yeah, you just reskin it on the fly to something appropriate. And
exactly.
Test the.
It would be easy to do.
Test the rolls, make sure they work. That's it.
Job, I know you're still working on Dying Earth, I guess, right? Jen, do you have top secret stuff to tell us?
I have absolutely no top secret stuff to tell you. However, I should note that thanks to our previous episode, I had a copy of Angels, Demons, and Beings Between Under the Tree this week. Ah. It was awesome.
Ah, very nice.
And being the completist that my husband is, I also got the set of CDM JDR as opposed to DCC RPG. I got the Clásicos del Mas Morero, the Dungeon Crawl Classics in Spanish.
Oh, wow.
That's like, awesome. I'm not sure I'm going to be, you know, driving to Miami to run DCC anytime soon, but it's kind of cool to have. I just don't know if I'll be going through everything. I tell you, the judges screen pretty much weirds me out because they've translated everything, and I'm trying to follow through, and I just don't know. But I think it'd be great to just slide that across to somebody at an upcoming convention. Oh, hey, you can use my screen and throw them for a loop.
That's awesome.
How's your Spanish, Jen? Could you actually run it for Spanish speakers?
I can read it. I can't speak it freeform. Ah. I butcher conjugations. 3 years of Spanish, and I can't conjugate verbs to save my life.
Yeah, we have a Brazilian contingent, right? Do they have a Portuguese version, or do those guys just do it in English?
It's my understanding they're working on Portuguese. In the meantime, Diogo's actually pimping out his sharp swords and sinister spells system, which is all in English, surprisingly. Hmm. Pretty fun little thing. And how is Nowhere City going?
We are doing a playtest of my next, what I'm sort of intending to be my first published adventure. So I'm doing a little funnel adventure. I'm going to be running it at GaryCon and hoping that it's in a, you know, sort of a third or fourth playtest mode. Maybe final playtest by then. So I'm doing the first one in January, pretty much written except for the kinky little trap thing that I have to just sit down with the battle map and figure out for about an hour.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Oh, it'll be fun. Some people like that stuff, I'm told. Puzzles. It's all puzzles.
It'll be interesting to see Nowhere City as a funnel. That's a pretty interesting setting.
It's kind of a sort of an artificial idea of how that would happen. But once I began to consider it, I thought, well, funnel would never. First, I thought, of course, well, funnel doesn't really work in Nowhere City. And then as I considered it more, I said, that's exactly the kind of challenge that I like. So how would I make a funnel? And then thought it would be kind of fun to give people maybe a little bit of an entry point.
Okay, that works.
And it's going to be brutal. I know Joe will be into it. The idea of, like, taking 25, like, 21st century contemporary civilians into a funnel and having them get mowed down versus peasants. I mean, I don't know. Is it going to be too creepy for people?
It doesn't sound like it's going to be creepy enough. You should, like, pre-populate the table with, like, children and nuns and...
Well, there's... Yeah, absolutely. We got modern occupations. I mean, I could... Yeah, we could do some...
Crank up the awkwardness is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, okay. Make sure there's an age table and a...
Kids with cancer and a child with a brand new puppy.
Make sure we get a younger person at the table at GaryCon so that we can see if I can make the kids cry.
Yeah, emotional millennial. Let's talk about this offline, okay? I got a bunch for you.
That's good to know. Anything else we need to hit? Or you sure, Jen, you don't have any big top secret stuff for us?
I am just the little red quill of doom. I don't write any of this. I don't schedule any of it either, if that helps.
Well, if there's nothing else, you can move over to summon email.
You've got mail.
Message for you, sir. Summon email.
Here we go. Jen, would you like to read the first one?
I suppose I could do that. First one comes from Michael Vergamini, if I have not butchered that one as well. I'm sorry. He says, "Hey, Spellburners, love the podcast. It's getting me through a dry gaming spell. When you discuss elves and possibly dwarves, I'd like to bring up something that I've found important in my games, the age of elves in relation to the humans in the party. As a consequence of a small world-building design, a player running a character that may have already lived to 100-plus years of game time may well have encountered many of the nobles, dragons, wizards, and other named NPCs of the setting, including ancestors of the PCs. He may have lived through several wars, dynasties, and other world-changing events, and can be a useful way to introduce background elements. To describe the life experiences of such an aged character without actually granting XP, I like to use a Bardic lore house rule, where if the PC asks if he's familiar with a place, person, or legend, I'd request a luck skill check. Success indicates he can share something useful or make a helpful introduction. Failure indicates that not only can he share some background history, but it was a negative interaction, and their history may color their encounter. A petty god may have been a spurned lover, or he had a hunting accident with the Duke's son. Encourage the player to describe how their relation fell apart, and they can take some agency and invest in your NPCs. My elves tend to have a string of broken hearts already strung out for a judge to exploit. I find this helps alleviate the syndrome of playing an elf character as simply a human with Spock ears. Would love to hear how you capture the alienness of elves and other non-human characters. Keeping the fun in funnel, Frankie." Do you have any thoughts on this one, guys? Have you done anything different with elves or demi-humans?
I actually did a lot of that stuff back when I played AD&D in the 80s. I really emphasized that elves were quite old, and I even had like naming conventions for the generations of them, and ones that were 1,000 years old versus ones that were only a few centuries old, and then younger ones. And, you know, I guess we assumed that adventuring parties were made up of younger ones, because once you're a few centuries old, you don't want to screw around in the dark with a bunch of chainmail murder hobos. I think it's great what he's talking about there. I think it adds a lot of flavor. If you want to, you know, I think, you know, not everybody brings out that element. It's very kind of Tolkien-based, and not everybody conceives elves that way. GCC kind of downplays some of the Tolkien influence, but if you like that and want to go with it, I think those ideas that are mentioned are really nice and give the environment a lot of color.
Yeah, I agree with you about that, Julian. I haven't really done much in the way of trying to flesh out elves any more than what the players have wanted to do. Part of it in DCC is, he was mentioning, it was like a human with Spock ears. You know, I mean, the elves have infravision and allergy, I guess, basically to iron, but I've never really had that come out at the table any kind of interesting way. So I don't know. Now I want to put like an iron rung ladder or something it to my next adventure. Elves, I think are pretty similar to the wizard class in all respects, really.
I do try to emphasize the iron allergy thing because it does keep them a little alien. I think that's DCC's mode there, is to emphasize that. And Mithril, of course, that they might use as that they get a free Mithril weapon or whatever when they're first level and so on. You know, that's expensive and hard to come by. So if they lose it, it's a real pain in the butt. As well as if you see Mithril stuff, you know there probably were elves around and stuff. So those things kind of give some flavor. I've done a little bit of that in my home campaign, and I tend to kind of emphasize that angle. But there's a lot more you could do with it than just that. I guess I also had a recent encounter where the person that hired the adventurers was a dark elf lady, and they went into this ancient tomb and stuff, and they discovered her undead sister. And I think they suddenly realized how old the other woman was when they realize that this was her sister in the tomb, and it's clearly been hidden away for centuries or something. So that was kind of fun. But Jen, what do you think?
I think the fact that the elves are just as good at swinging a sword as a cleric can be kind of speaks to the fact that they're wizards plus. You know, they do have that extra experience even in their zero level lifetime. And as far as bringing a character in and you know, seeing if he's familiar with that person or place or, you know, this bit of folklore, I'll often do that if I have a new player sit down at the table for our campaign game, regardless of their race or their age. but just because, hey, here's the opportunity for a new plot device. Overall, if you've got a set number of players and characters and everything, and you've got the elf there, yeah, put them to use, by all means.
What Job said is interesting, because when you said Wizards Plus, as I'm kind of ruminating it here, it's funny because they're not great warriors, obviously, when you think of not having the deed or the critical range and so on.
But right, kind of in line with a cleric.
But when you think of them compared to wizards, they basically have the power that wizards do. Maybe one fewer spell or something, right?
Actually, one extra spell.
Oh, because they all get a patron bond and invoke patron.
Hmm? Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So even though they kind of have that dual role, they actually seem to be much closer to wizards in their power profile.
I like what the book says about their multi-centenarian lifespan. They're not often of lawful alignment because they've been around so long, they get a little jaded.
Just like me.
Yeah. All right. Well, good email. Thank you so much, Frankie.
Yes.
Someone else can take the next one.
Joe, would you like to read that one?
Certainly. Okay. So this is from Jason Beck. Greetings, judges. I love DCC RPG. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work. Thank you. I've played in a handful of DCC con games, ran a few funnels, and started running a campaign recently where my players are first level. I have a few questions about death and dying in DCC. Question cluster one. With the rule to heal a player with a number of rounds equal to their level to have them not die, I find that player death after level zero is impossible. They lose a stamina point, get back up, and keep on trucking. The only time I've ever had a character actually die was when an NPC and a PC dropped in the same round and the cleric chose to heal their party member. I'm not a vicious DM out to kill all the players like Judge Job, but something seems to be missing. Am I doing something wrong? Do you handle this differently? So let's kick this over to Jen first.
If a player's not rolled over in the next round, they're dead. They get to make that luck check. It's often that only one person falls, and someone else can go tend to them that next round. But it doesn't have to be magical healing, I don't believe. They just have to be rolled over. I'll double check on that one. But it has happened that there are plenty of times where multiple characters drop and you can't get to all of them at the same time.
I think you can roll them over after the round is up, but you have to heal them magically within their number of rounds equal to their level, right?
Yes, you're right. Yeah. It is magical healing. It has to be like lay on hands. But if he's not healed before the second round, what I do is if he's, say, segment five or whatever of one round, I'll let the entire next round go past, below segment five to zero. Mm. And when the second round hits, dude, if he's not up by then, sorry, someone's going to have to recover him later.
I wouldn't agree with Jason that after the funnel that it's impossible, but by like second or third level, it's pretty hard to kill somebody since they get as many rounds as their level.
Unless the cleric goes down.
The cleric is the weak link there for sure. I mean, it's certainly my experience too, and my players are getting very good tactically in terms of the cleric rushes to the Memnock, the wizard, who always goes down because he's fourth level and has 8 hit points still.
Yeah.
But the balancing act there is that you keep losing that stamina point. He's stamina now. And he's going to start losing hit points because the next time it happens, his overall stamina penalty will increase too.
That's only if you get as far as rolling the die, though.
No, you actually, when you drop and get healed, you still lose a stamina point, I believe.
It's when you're recovering. Like, after that luck check is made, then you lose a random ability between the three.
I believe if when you die, in this exact situation where you're dropped, you're zero or below, you actually lose a stamina point. It's a different rule than the luck roll.
Right. That's bleeding out versus recovering the body.
Yeah.
If nobody gets to him, then he could potentially...
No, they'll lose anything, yeah.
Right.
Any physical point, yeah.
But even just bleeding out, yeah, you lose that stamina every time. It is possible to become unplayable. We had one of our characters during the Linkmar playtest hit that point. He couldn't breathe anymore. He had, like, a hit point at level 3. It got pretty pathetic.
Does that same mechanic, now I know that healing is different in Lankmar, is there still sort of a thing like that?
There's still ramifications of this nature, and that's one of the reasons we were playtesting it for about a year, is to see, okay, is this going to work for a campaign play? You know, do any of these rules need to be tweaked a little bit? And I can't tell you the end result of that, not only because of the whole unspoken NDA thing, but I honestly haven't gotten feedback off of it yet. So okay. that may or may not be changing. So anyway.
Anyway, before we confuse the hell out of everybody, let's just flip through the rules real quick, because it's only a couple paragraphs to make sure that everyone's on the same page.
Yes.
So, bleeding out, there's a chance of saving a dead character by healing them very quickly, such as with Lay on Hands. A zero-level character is always killed at 0 hit points, but a first-level character reaches 0 hit points, collapses, and begins bleeding out. Such a character has one round in which he can be healed to prevent death. If he's healed on the round, he's reduced to 0 hit points, or the next round he's healed per the result of Lay on Hands check. Treat his hit points as starting at 0. He's not healed before the second round. He may permanently be killed. We'll talk about that in a second. For each level past first, characters has one more round of bleeding out before he's killed. So, for example, third level character has 3 rounds. Character that was bleeding out but was saved suffers permanent physical trauma from his near-fatal injuries. So if you get reduced to 0 hit points is when you're 1 stamina point. So anyone who is saved from bleeding out suffers a permanent loss of 1 point of stamina. In addition, he gains a terrible scar from the wound that, like,
so
you
that's
said,
bleeding out.
Yeah. So you get reduced to 0, you're going to lose that point of stamina and get a scar. Then there's recovering the body. So if you do die,
if you're not rolled over while bleeding out,
there's a chance that you might not be killed. So the character reaches a dead ally's body within 1 hour. Oh, I forgot about that rule. So you have 1 hour, and then the dead character gets to make a luck check when his body's rolled over. On a successful check, the character is badly injured but not permanently killed. In quotes, dead character was simply knocked out, stunned, or otherwise incapacitated. Once the ally shakes the downed character awake, he recovers to 1 hit point. He's groggy for the next hour, so -4 penalty to all rolls. And he gets a permanent injury of some kind, reflected as a permanent -1 penalty to strength, agility, or stamina, determined randomly. There's the actual rules, so we're all on the same page.
There's 93.
93. Thank you, yeah. And I think the bleeding out one is tough, because you can be saved many times, but that stamina really is going to get you. Whereas being flipped is, you know, if you're a wizard and you lose a few strength and a few agility here and there, it's not going to affect you the same way. But if you lose 5-6 stamina, you could be in real trouble.
I have heard players say, "I have enough luck. I'll chance it. Let me die."
I've got guys who have more than 19 luck. So clearly I need to, you know, get up the challenge a little bit. So these guys have to spend some luck.
There you go. Okay, so there's that question handled.
Okay, so question 2. If and when a character actually dies, at what level do you introduce their new character? Level 0 level or robust? Same level as their previous character? This hasn't happened yet, but I'd like to be prepared. Thanks again, Judge Jason. P.S. Oh, and Judge Jen, thanks for letting me pester you with 1,000 questions at Gen Con this year whilst you were manning the GG booth.
Anytime.
So, Julian, I picked on Jen first last time. I'll pick on you. What would you do?
Well, I have this a lot because in my home campaign, we have some kind of recurring core characters, but we also introduce newbies occasionally. And then we haven't had a lot of character death in this campaign yet, but I play it pretty fluid. I mean, I ask people what they want to do. I've had people who wanted to start with zeros. I've had people who wanted to join at the regular, you know, level of the rest of the party. I've had my friend Gary Fortoyne wanted to play with the third level party with 3 first level clerics, one of each alignment, who were sent to join the party to determine which alignment was correct.
Oh, fun.
And that was a pretty cool idea. So, and of course, by the end, that was the Sea Queen escapes, and we knew which one was correct because only 2 of them made it to the end of the adventure. So, I don't know, at the end of the day, I'm sure some judges would say, 0 level or else, but, you know, to me, it's like, we're having fun. If somebody has a preference, I probably slot them in. My old AD&D rule in the 80s and 90s was you join at the average level of the party minus one. You're a junior person, so you're one level down. And generally, I have done pretty much that, or, you know, the same if they're lower end of that level, or one level down if they're at the higher level. Jen?
For con games, it'll totally depend on what I'm running. If it's a playtest, I have additional pre-gens available at the same level, because the idea is just to try to work the bugs out of whatever we're playing. Oddly enough, I run playtests more often than anything at conventions. In my campaign, usually the question is, when a new player comes in, what are they at? If it's an existing player, chances are they already have another character prepped because they started with multiple zeros and I fail at killing everyone off, so, or my dice do, rather. So I'll let them work in one of their other characters, even if it's a first level compared to all the fourth level ones going on. And at least that way they have something they're already familiar with. And much in the case of Julian's game, it keeps everybody happy. Short, sweet, and simple. Job?
I don't do anything appreciably different than you guys. It's definitely not a level zero or bust. I usually just bring in another character the same level and go from there. Find them in a barrel or something. If you're in the middle of adventure, a lot of times I'll you know, if there's hirelings or something, let the dead player take over the hirelings, at least for a while, until maybe they roll another character or something off in the corner. Yeah, that's about it. That's all I have to say on that.
Hey, I will add that one thing that's worked for us is, because we sometimes only have three or four guys at the table and we don't have everybody's class covered, you know, somebody will run a little henchman thief or a little henchman cleric or whatever. And those guys have eventually been on some adventures and rack up some experience and stuff. And they also get attached to those characters a little. So they're also, now it's getting to be where, like, my core guys have a stable of those guys being natural backups, right? They've been on a few adventures. They might be first or second level. And if their main guys died, then, you know, they've got somebody out there who's had a few levels.
Makes sense.
In Jeffrey's game, didn't they have, like, a stable of people or something?
Like all the little hirelings?
Yeah, I thought they had like a stable of recurring kind of hirelings, yeah, or, you know, characters that they would like rotate in and out sometimes. So like on the next adventure, you know, the player might bring a different character instead of the one they played in previously.
That's a cool way to do it, because some variety, and plus some games the guy playing the thief doesn't show up, so you need a thief, and right, you swap, exactly. Right?
Yeah, I did a thing where one group went off for essentially the one who watches from below. And then a couple of games later when that was wrapped, okay, simultaneously, this other thing was going on with these characters that weren't ever brought in. So they got a chance to play both of their characters without a huge loss in game time. Gives them a bit of a variety.
Okay, perfect. Well, I think we've answered this question. So if you guys out there want to write us, you know, we're always looking for more email to read on the show and more questions to answer. You can contact us at theband@spellburn.com.
One new email will be in our next episode, I think we can say. At least one. So send us some emails for sure. All right, with that, hey, I think we can go on to Mighty Deeds and we can talk about how to break the game.
Wait a second. I have an idea.
That's plenty for the both of us.
I move for no man.
Ow.
Mighty Deeds.
We'll go ahead and dive into tactics and some iffy tactics around the table, both from what we got suggested. So I did launch a little thread on our DCC RPG G Plus group, and I want to thank all the people who contributed, because and I'll kind of call you out by name as we go on the meteor ideas that some of you gave. So thanks again for the input, and we'll kind of respond point by point and share our own thoughts and pet peeves and so on. I think the first thing that came up was Job, so you can talk about that one. It sounded very specific, like maybe you'd had a bad experience with this one.
You know, we were talking about kind of game-breaking rules that are part of the core game, and the patron, King of Elfland, pretty simply has, if you invoke patron with a 28, 29, and higher, the caster can go back in time 1d6 plus caster level hours and make some changes. I just wanted to bring that up as pretty achievable, you know, possibly game-breaking thing. Judge Jim Wampler used to always say that he broke the end of The One Who Watches from Below with a spell, but I still killed a bunch of people, so I don't think it really was broken. It's working as advertised, but, you know, this is one of those things, you know, if you're the player out there looking like for a trump card, you want to take the King of Elfland as your patron, and you've got this go back in time 1d6 plus Castle of Hours and make some changes. And actually, I was just going to bring this one up because this actually saved some level one adventurers in The One Who Watches from Below when I ran it from my home group. They had two people go down at the same time, and the cleric was only able to heal one of them in time, and they rolled the body, and that character was dead. But I think the reason the second character went down was because some monster picked up a spear or something and like threw it across the room or something. And I just happened to crit. Yeah, like they had full hit points, and it was just like a totally wild ass lucky roll, and they went down and were dead. So the caster, after they rolled and found out he wasn't awake, didn't live. He did the King of Elfland thing. He thought of it real quick, and then he like ran up behind the dude and like plucked the weapon out of his hand. And I was like, okay, you can totally do that. So it prevented the second person from going down. And then Then I made him replay. That was like the second to last round. So I made him replay like last couple rounds of combat. Anyway, if you're looking for a game-breaking rule as a player, this one can cause some fits for your judges out there.
Can I just like retitle this section to, hey, players, we want to make it fun for everyone. Please don't do this crap. Or at least do it in moderation, not every single time you sit down to a con table.
Well, I will say, players, here's how to do this one, okay? Because this one is tricky, actually. This one is it is a very powerful result, but it's tricky because this is an invoke patron result for the King of Elfland, and this invoke patron is one where the results are all different, and you cannot just take the lower one. You know, if you were to get a 30 instead of a 28, you can't slide down to the 28. You would become rather than doing your time travel, you'd become an elven paladin and so on, which could be cool, but doesn't get you the time travel thing. You could. So the way to do it is not, you know, spell burn or anything, and then burn luck to roll to up yourself to the 28. Of course, you may not have luck to burn, but you might have a halfling or something. Not that I'm, you know, tipping anybody off there, but this is a hard result to get. It is a very powerful thing, but it's only two. It's a 28 and a 29, and the other results are not like it. The one related that I did give a GM fits at Gamehole Con recently was Forest Walk, which is really powerful. So again, King of Elfland patron spell. I mean, on just a 20, the caster and up to 1d4 plus caster level allies step through a tree and are instantly transported to another tree up to 100 miles distant as long as it's in the same forest. And that's just on a 20. A little spell burn or a luck or a lucky roll, you can be in business. And you can do much crazier stuff if you get significantly higher than 20. Your range and number of allies to transport increases radically. We were in a con game. I was actually playing, and the Minneapolis guys, Clint Bohady and John and Trevor and so on. And we were giving the GM fits a little bit because it was Clint Bohady who was using this spell a lot. And we're like, well, we'll go back across time and space through this tree over to the other tree. Let me just spell burn. And that's a very powerful spell as well.
Well, that kind of ties into one of your pet peeves, Julian, spell burn itself. My philosophy is go ahead, spell burn, get rid of those stats because you'll need them later.
The reason I paint myself into corner with this a little bit as a judge is because I tend to do very episodic sessions. Even in my long-term campaign, we don't usually stop in the middle of the crawl. So that next time that we get together, that, you know, many of the faces will be different. You know, probably half the guys are the same, but we might have 2 to 3 new guys. So it makes a lot easier to schedule and get people together if we don't have to pick up in the middle of the dungeon. But the downside of that is you don't really get to punish people with spellburn typically, because, you know, obviously Memnock the Wizard is not going to go into another dungeon if he's not spellburn healed by them, right?
Well, he will if the rest of the party wants to right then and there. What's he going to do, sit by himself and wait for a wandering encounter?
But they're not even in the dungeon, right? He'd sit in his in behind a locked door and an armed guard.
Oh, so you let them take breaks at the end.
That's what I'm saying. My sessions
You're predictable.
My sessions tend to be pretty self-contained because I don't always get people, all the same crew back at the next game. So I do run in a very episodic way.
Okay.
Well, it's the same issue with cons, right?
It is the same issue as cons, kind of. Except in con, you really don't give it.
Yeah.
Right? Because you burn all your luck, too, and just go nuts, of course. I've been thinking about this because we're doing this episode, and I think I might house rule this. Because the way I approach it doesn't, you know, have the built-in penalty of you still need your stats later, I might get a tougher with Spellburn. And the thing I've been really thinking about is change the rule that if you roll a 1, you lose 1 point of your abilities permanently, to if you roll a 1 when you Spellburn, you lose all of the Spellburned points permanently.
Oof.
Well, I thought we were going to save that stuff for the Mercurial Magic section.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
As a preview, we're going to piss off the GMs in this section, and then we're going to help the judges in the Mercurial Magic section.
So as a player, obviously the way to do this is to look at your spell table, and you can really try to figure out where your dice are going to fall, you know, what you have the best chance at. And then, you know, you carefully burn your stats so that you get in the range that you want for the desired effect. Of course, you can't. It's not like luck where you can burn it after the roll. But, you know, you can still be kind of conservative or aggressive depending on the result that you're trying to get. Right.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So what else have we got contributed out there from the community?
Terry Olson had mentioned Second Sight and Detect Evil.
Second Sight is not that bad because you even the judge has a little bit of leeway with that one. You first roll a percentile to see some of the results are, okay, there's a 50 or 75% chance that you're going to receive correct information. You make that percentile roll and the judge has a moment to kind of collect thoughts and give the person a little tidbit of information and nobody knows whether or not it's correct. That one, I think, has a little bit of leeway there. Detect Evil, however, I thought it was so funny that Terry Olson was the one to bring it up because when he had my group playtesting Escape from the Shrouded Fen, first thing someone does when they enter the Fen is detect evil. And the result they got was just a result between 18 and 19. And that's a range of 120 feet in all directions from the cleric. Creatures of opposed alignment are automatically detected, as well as objects inherently dangerous in nature, such as traps and cursed weapons. And evil creatures do not receive a will save to remain undetected. There goes every single surprise attack for the duration of the spell.
Which is 6 turns. I looked this up because I thought it doesn't even vary. This is what kills me. And when I read the spell, because I saw Terry's comment, I said, well, how bad is that? And it's always 6 turns. I mean, that result that you read is at 18 to 19, Jen?
Yeah.
So that's
pretty simple.
Yeah. Your spell check is probably, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, depending on your level at least. So you're talking about rolling a 13 on the dice. And you're getting an hour of that result that you read, which, whew.
On the bright side, you know, 1 turn is estimated up at the end of each combat. But still, even if they're wandering for 10 minutes and then there's a combat, well, there's 20 minutes gone, there's still 40 minutes left of the thing.
So players, if you don't drop a detect evil, basically every chance you get, and again when it runs out, you're stupid, right? If you got it, if your cleric has it, you got to be rolling with it. I mean,
essentially,
right? You're suboptimal.
Unless you are a chaotic cleric, at which point you might not notice that much because this is specifically the opposed alignment or creatures of opposed alignments. And if you're in some sort of evil old temple, well, most of the stuff there is going to be chaotic too. So that would be a step in the judge's helpful direction.
Yeah, hopefully you're not a cleric of Cthulhu. There are no opposed.
Just neutral. One of the other ones that popped up in the G+ thread was from Tony Tucker. And he mentioned the Scoundrel class from Transylvanian Adventures. So I pulled that one up here. Yeah, I kind of see why this would be a Judge's Bane. First off, all the specifically Transylvanian classes start with base ACs because there's nothing that is lower than leather armor in this game. Starts off with a base AC of 14, which is 30% higher than most characters. A D8 hit die. Which is okay, not too bad, like a cleric. They get a deed die, just like a warrior or dwarf. They get thief skills. I believe those thief skills are, you get to choose two from the list of pretty much every single thief skill in there. You recover 1 point of luck per day, no matter what. You get the option, or not even the option, it is an automatic. You may make a reflex save once per round to deflect a melee attack and parry it away. The only thing you can't avoid is a crit. And the thing that really gets me is that at second level, you get a second action die. Yeah, as opposed to warriors getting that second action die at level 5, where you start with the d20 and the d14. At second level, you begin with a d20 and a d6. So it's not too high, but it means you could still make a thief skill check at the same time. So you could potentially try to get around and do a backstab. Tony, I totally see where you're on with this one. This one is, it's a little overly powerful for a regular DCC flavor game.
Takeaway for the players out there is get this book and then try to convince your judge that, hey, I want to try this class from the Transylvania Adventures in a DCC game.
It's not the only one that's a little overpowered, but this one, in the scheme of all of the other, the new classes that are put forth, this one is, wow. Oh, and as part of the class, you also get one free natural 20, per session. You can use it for an attack roll, a skill check, or a saving throw.
I gotta ask, since I'm a Spellburn geek, a long time ago, Job, you mentioned that you played the Transylvanian Adventures game at a con. You said that you had a crazy game you got away with. I mean, you were just massively successful, and at one point you were like punching a shark to death.
Yes.
Were you playing a scoundrel? Now I gotta know.
Jed, weren't you in that game?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember.
My dice were so hot. He was like, yeah, you know, he was trying to scare me out of the water with a shark. And I was just rolling 19s and 20s every single time. So I just jumped in on it. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to punch the crap out of this shark. And he's like, okay, roll for it. And I was like, got a 19 or 20. Like, I just, the whole game, I've never been on that on with my rolls ever.
There's no tactic that equals hot dice, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and usually when the player's dice are hot, the judge's dice are just completely ice cold.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Next, we had Todd Bradley mentioned Cleric's Healing Spellburn. And I think specifically that would happen with the Restore Vitality spell, in theory. But Joseph and team were on that, I would say, pretty well, because they say it both in page 108 and in the spell description that the cleric and the patron are at cross purposes. The gods are not giving away power so that you can heal somebody who's serving a different entity, right? You should really not do that. So, Todd, here's the way to do it. Clearly, if the cleric is of the same alignment and the wizard is of this, or elf are of the same alignment, and are also working together to get the Vecna's head so they can burn him and have a victory for the forces of law, then, you know, maybe you can make an argument to your judge that, in fact, your lawful deity would indeed help you restore the spellburn because the wizard and the cleric, in fact, were working toward the same purpose. Huh?
Yeah, maybe. Once.
Once? Okay.
There would have to be a limit for it. The wizard just cast four or five things that burned stats down all the way. Well, the cleric gets one shot to try to do this because your god is only so understanding. Gods tend to not have favorable views upon the arcane powers in the first place, I thought.
They're still jealous, right? But like you say, once, right? You can make an argument. It would be cool to happen once. Come on, we're both waffle.
I'd give it to you once. If you do it again, there'll be some interesting things happening. But I'm not going to straight out tell you no. The spell itself, at a result of 16 to 19, it's a second level spell, first off. So you're automatically going to have a bonus of 2 for it. Between 16 and 19, you restore 2 points of any of those lost stats. But if you bump it up to 20 or 21, it becomes 1d4 plus cleric level or 2d4 plus cleric level if there's no broken bones or anything like that. So you go from 2 points to 2d4 plus cleric level pretty quick. And that's why I'm like, I'd allow it once.
Well, I will say this. There's another good tactic that's kind of implicit in this, my response there, which is play the cleric and the wizard of the same alignment. In fact, if you're just looking to optimize and can't take sort of a different games approach to DCC, why you would do that, I can't really say. But if you were trying to really optimize, then you got to play everybody of the same alignment. You're maximizing your healing. You're getting rid of some of those, you know, cleric versus wizard patron type conflicts. That's just part of optimize. You're eliminating some PvP opportunities. Why you would do that, I have no clue.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I think Todd also said, and I totally agree with this, massive spell burn on a wizard's own casting a patron bond. That there alone is guaranteed to give, you're going to go off in the woods and do it on your own time. You're not under the gun in the Croaking Fame Temple, right? You put on some Kenny G and you burn some incense and you have 10 armed guards outside and then you cut yourself into smithereens and you do your patron bond. You're stupid if you don't maximize your patron bond spell.
You know what? You could probably even do a ritualized version too to jack up even more.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So if you're not familiar with the ritual magic rules, it's in the magic section, I think, somewhere. But basically, there's some things that you can do, like going to special places, temples, whatnot, or having other casters help you, and that you can bump up the spell results even more.
And I think the difference is that it takes turns or hours instead of just rounds to cast something. I'm so torn on this, though, because massive spell burn for anything is awesome, but I'm so stuck on that alternate rule of, hey, if you spell burn 20, it's an automatic success, as if you have just rolled a 20. That's an optional rule, and it's so hard to keep this for Mercurial Magic. I just can't let that one stand. Roll the dice, roll the one, see if you actually make it, because otherwise you're just forcing that optimization.
First of all, I want you to take the risk, but second of all, it's not a good trade-off. I mean, you just quickly do the math. If you're burning 20 points, you exchange that for an automatic crit, as you would say on the die, you're doubling your caster level. You're probably first level if you're patron bonding. It might be second, so you're getting an extra 2 or 4. But if you burn 20 points of ability for spell burn and you roll a 10, you're at a 30. You're giving up a 5% chance of rolling a 1, but even on a 2, you're going to be at a 22 plus your spell check.
Right, and a 22 is much different than the 36 plus on the spell chart. So from a player standpoint, yeah, it's smart to go ahead and spell burn everything you can. And I've seen players spell burn 30 points before.
Oh yeah, if you got them.
That falls under the category of things that can really affect things differently.
Yeah, you know, actually, here's another tip for the spellcasters out there. So this is something I discovered recently. I was like working up some tables of like what the percentage for rolling specific spell check results are depending on caster level and your intelligence modifier. One thing that's interesting, say if you calculate all the ranges out for the particular spell that you have in your spell book, the lumpiness of the spell check tables, you know how there's some like results where there's 2 and there's some results are like a range of like 4 or more rolls,
yes.
Right? You know, if you check out what your rules are, a lot of the higher spell check results are more probable than a lower spell check result because there's more die faces that you're able to roll in that range. Just like spell checks, if you go through your spell check tables, if you want a particular result, like that one on the Invoke Patron where it's only a range of 2, it's actually a little bit harder than you think to hit it exactly because there's more die faces in the other spell check result levels.
Yeah.
So if you compute out what all of your options are, you can actually kind of try to optimize your spell checks a little bit for particular results. I mean, you know that I want to hit this thing that's there's only 2 die faces, but it's actually a lower probability of hitting that lower check than a higher one, for example. Or it might help you. I mean, say you want the higher one.
Yeah.
And why are we helping them again?
Well, we're building them up and then we're going to rip them down in the next section.
Piece by piece.
Stephen Mirsch wrote in about funnel initiative. So, you know, when you've got 5-6 people at your table and everybody's got 2-4 PCs, level zeros, if they win on initiative, you're looking at 10, 20 or more attacks landing on your monsters before they get a chance to go, even if they get a really high initiative. So,
well, there's not much the players can do about that. Yeah, you know, that's not something they can optimize, at least.
They could burn luck.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know.
Yeah, maybe, for sure. For sure.
If you guys are out there in the funnel, you might want to burn luck to make sure you go first so that you guys have a better chance of taking out those monsters before they even get to hit you.
Which is, let's face it, as a player, it's especially advantageous on a funnel game because Stumpy the potato farmer, who's got sevens and everything, who cares what his luck score is? I mean, he's your luck battery, right?
Yeah, and usually, you know, the way the rules are, it says when you have a bunch of characters in level zero, you take the highest initiative bonus.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So maybe even take your guy with the highest agility and have him burn a few points of luck afterwards to make sure they go first.
I would say, hey, you might be taking, you know, Renfro's agility modifier, but couldn't we take Stumpy's luck, you know, to spend on it? Because, hey, we're all in the same funnel team here, you know, of my four guys.
I wouldn't let that fly.
No, because then if Renfro survives and levels up, his luck is unchanged. And I don't think that's not kosher. Hey, Job and I actually agree on something.
Well, you're trying to mix two characters' abilities there. I wouldn't let that happen.
You'll be hearing from my RPG attorney in the morning.
He's not a halfling yet, dude.
Yes, indeed. Okay, but that is a good one. I mean, that's a real thing that can and does happen in games. So that's a big advantage fighting those 3-hit point funnel adventure critters, for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Kevin Weatherwax expressed concern of clerical powers being overused and then resting to overcome that. And was that meant to take the place of things like making the offerings or hitting disapproval from the gods? Because I could see that, but the option of resting to overcome that totally lies with the judge of whether or not they get downtime.
He says, I find players try to rest up fully in ridiculous situations. So such as, you know, maybe stopping in the middle of the dungeon and resetting their disapproval, right? Getting their 8 hours of sleep in the middle of the dungeon. I assume this is what he's talking about.
We can go to Maxwell Spann's email from last episode about the blessing spell. So you roll in the 24 plus range in the spell effect, grant the party bonus of cast level plus 1d3 to all rolls, basically, for a full turn, as long as they're within 10 feet. And then it gets worse from there, and you can even cast it on allies, too.
So players, here's the deal. Bless and Detect Evil are excellent first level spells. Second Sight.
Stop!
Second Sight sucks. Right? It can be devastating if you always make your rolls, but I've had two games in the last 3 or 4 months where the characters got a bad result on Second Sight. They actually got they rolled their percentile to get the opposite call from their deity. Mm-hmm. And one guy was this guy named Bob at Gamehole Con, and he cast Second Sight about, should we stay on the trail or should I dive into the mud where the zombies are and fight them?
Oh, God, that's what that was.
And his deity told him, yeah, Bob, go into the mud and dive into the mud and fight the zombies. As a cleric, what are you going to do when your god tells you to do something?
Absolutely.
He didn't hesitate. He was I'm a militant, badass cleric. I'm going to, so, which is great.
And he did.
He sure did. And it was awesomely hilarious. Really suboptimal. I mean, look at how great Detect Evil is. I mean, Detect Evil can be your second sight if you can detect all inherent things and people of opposing alignments and no. Why the heck would you mess around with Second Sight? So everybody, when you get to the table and they gave you Second Sight, go, oh, hey, Judge Jen, could I swap Second Sight out for Detect Evil?
Yeah, chances are if it's a pre-gen, no.
Well, you know, there's just as many wizard spells that you can exploit like that, too. Like Enlarge, you know, you can get somebody, it's like maybe 28 plus, I think, which is hard to get at first, but you can do like +6 for all attack rolls and something else, and they grow by a huge amount. And it lasts caster level plus 1d3 turns or something like that. Once you're a few levels up there, it's like every battle, while you're tromping through the dungeon, just keep casting enlarge on your warriors or your dwarves or whatnot and
it's
send them
like
in.
It's like hasting the party, yeah.
Yeah, and you just walk around by this behind the giant warrior, like stumbling into every room. Another one I remember that we got as a call a long time ago is Featherfall. I don't know if you guys, if it was one of your games, Jen, or maybe it was Jeffrey's.
Yeah.
It's instantaneous 25 feet, and like somebody was like jumping on them, and they cast Featherfall so that the monster just fell to the ground super slow, and then they just shot the crap out of it while it was falling. And it couldn't do anything, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's great, though. That's really good tactics.
Yeah.
Well, they deserve that. That's very creative. I like that. I'd give them a luck point for that.
Yeah, but then when you do it every single time.
When it's used creatively, especially the first time, hell yeah, there's luck in it for you.
Yeah, that's a little corner of a corner case anyway. It's like, how often do you have somebody falling? I guess, I don't know, throw them off a cliff and then slow them down and keep shooting them on the way down or something.
So I would say, going to Kevin's point, I had a guy, Patrick Schifano, in my home campaign who played a cleric, and he was kind of a newbie, came in and played a cleric with us one day, and he just kept fearlessly casting over and over, and his disapproval was ratcheting up 3, 5, 6. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this guy's going to get in trouble. And, you know, he eventually did, but you know what? He just kept going and took his lumps and took a -1 here and -2 there. And the disapproval as written in the core book, it's not that bad. And it doesn't escalate that fast. I'm not sure that that's a bad tactic to be aggressive with it. And especially in a shorter term game, some of the stuff you get is, oh, you have to build a temple. And I think there's some room to be aggressive.
Especially when you look at it as opposed to resting in the middle of a dungeon. You know, unless you are totally secure, that's just not going to happen.
Correct.
Okay, so do we have another one here?
Jürgen.
To go through for Jürgen?
Yes.
Jürgen Meyer, the gentle German.
Judge Jürgen says that he's got a group with an elf that has a mercurial magic overpowered charm spell, as well as multiple characters with word of command. And yeah, it would be hard making boss fights difficult without just handing out immunity to mind control to all of the NPCs. I've had that break more than one playtest in my experience. All it takes is one person casting word of command or charm. Yeah. And I'm just going, damn, why isn't that giant deaf?
Yeah.
I wish that giant was deaf. Can he be now? No, he's already reacted to them. Damn it.
Players. Charm Person is a great spell, and it's better than the D&D version because there are higher results where you can actually get stuff that's less human, too, I believe. It's really a good spell, and you can... I had Mimalek the Wizard just completely destroy my encounter with some vigilant half-titans in our last adventure. It was, oh, sure.
It's like, all this effort I just went to, and you nerfed my big bad guy.
And you know what the best thing is? It's 180, right? You've got this big, you know, these bad guys, and you think it's going to be a great encounter, and then, or excuse me, as a player, you think it's going to be a tough encounter, and suddenly, these guys are your bodyguard. You don't just take them out of the picture. You're actually pumping them for information. You might even convince them to tag along and, you know, help deflect some damage down the road.
And this is definitely better than the AD&D spell, because for casting level 24, it's equal to 1d6 plus caster level. Number of creatures are affected. Each of those must make a will save, and then you get to the higher results, and anything that is equal or less than your hit die level don't even get a save. They just have to be humanoid. It's a mundane living humanoid. Druids can use the spell on animals, and wizards can attempt it on monsters and undead with a small penalty. Oh, and demons with a -4 check funnel. That's an incredible bonus.
You can't charm Manticrex. I just want to get that out of there.
Okay, I got to fix those stats, yeah.
I think takeaway for the players, we only touched on a few of the spells that are pretty exploitable this way, is if you have Word of Command in your spellbook, or whatever the spells that you have in your spellbook, I think maybe sometimes players just don't take the time to read carefully all the spell results. I would recommend everybody go through and don't just roll it at the table like, oh, I've got Magic Missile and I'm going to roll it now. No, go look through there and look at what results you have. and see,
and yeah, find the optimal one.
Yeah, see how you can use that to gain advantage.
It's like rope trick. It's not the rope trick that you guys are used to. Not at all.
People are conservative with luck, but man, you can go one level up on a spell result on 2 points of luck or something. That might be a no-brainer.
Yeah.
You know?
All right. So okay, now we flip this around or what?
Absolutely. We are going to go to Mercurial Magic, and we are going to now turn around and block these tactics.
Great all-seeing eye of Agamotto! You must come to my aid!
Doesn't weird stuff happen when spells are messed up?
I don't feel anything.
So that could have gone better.
Mercurial Magic.
So here we are in Mercurial Magic. We're taking off our players' hats, which we were wearing a little loosely to begin with, but, you know, we're taking them all the way off now.
We were?
Yeah.
Oh, and I forgot that part. Sorry.
Yeah. And we're putting on our judges' caps, and they fit really well, I think. And talking about what we do in some of these situations.
Without just outright saying no.
Nerfing is undesirable. That's a key assumption that I want to make about the way I think about this stuff. I think, Job, you kind of touched on this on a question a couple episodes ago where I don't remember the exact question, but it was somebody was exploiting some loophole or something, and you said, you know, don't nerf it. Just carefully control it, plan for it, and respond to it in the narrative, in the game itself, rather than just telling them no. We're not here to take stuff away from the players, right?
Yeah, I think that was the blessing thing for Maxwell Spann. React to it like it's natural. It's part of the rules. It's part of the game world. Just react to it. If these guys are mowing everything down, then maybe it's time demons are attacking them, or death knights, or, you know, just more powerful creatures are going to come sniffing around, because everybody weaker is going to be running away when they hear about this group of adventurers coming, you know? You create a vacuum of power, and then the stronger things are going to come. You're going to start attracting that.
That kind of fits in with what Harley Stroh responded on your thread with, Julian.
That's right. That's right. Haley Straw? Some that guy.
You're I saw horrible. That name.
Hey, Harley Stroh. Yeah, that gentleman had a very good considered response where he said, "Too often I get lost in the judge's grind where I really want the PCs to suffer, when really it is okay to let them rock out, and I need to remind myself that it is cool for the PCs to have an easy win now and then."
I struggle with that as well.
I totally know what Harley's saying there. And the tricky part there is we want all our games to be in that perfect zone of really hard, and the players just win out by the skin of their teeth, and maybe a couple die, right?
Yeah, it's when they haven't died yet that I start feeling like I need to become a little more stringent or a little more challenging. And there needs to be a little bit of a balance, not in the game, but in the judge's mindset.
And we have to kind of say to ourselves, players deserve to get rewards when they play smart. It's also a frickin' dice-based game. If the dice love the players, then the players are going to do pretty well.
Exactly. The judges do it because they love the game as well. The players are there to have fun, and it's kind of the judge's responsibility to make sure they don't leave the game going, "Oh, well, that sucked." Even if the players' dice really suck and they are dying, we should still try to make it fun.
I think that's, you know, some of that is the secret sauce of DCC right there. I mean, it's kind of like your power fantasy type of escapism, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You want to be able to do something crazy, kind of world-breaking. It feels good, you know, when you pull something off like that and it actually happens, you know?
Yes.
It is special when you get to that kind of perfect zone of, it was really challenging, but we won through it at great expense, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So having said all that, the dice are the dice. What happens, happens. I think sometimes you have to relinquish control a little bit. And let players be smart, let the dice go their way sometimes, and not feel like we were not tough enough, right?
Right.
Right.
The most
having said
one,
that, we're going to unleash hell on them right now.
Well, I don't know about that, but you know, one of the most egregious ones is you get to the big bad at the end of the adventure, and your wizards, your elf, or spell burns their stats to the ground and just decimates what, you know, whatever is out there. You know, how do you deal with that as a judge?
I'm of the firm impression that even people who don't consider them actors, if they're running a game, they're still touching on things like improv, because you have to be able to roll with it. Okay, so they killed your big bad. You could either throw your hands up and say, you know, F this, I'm out of here, you guys broke everything, or roll with it, keep things going, and try to find a happy middle ground so that everybody leaves the table happy. I say happy a lot, but they're going to be ecstatic that they won, and you're going to be happy that they had a good time. If you just say, well, screw that, you guys broke my game, I don't want to play this anymore. No. See, I got to say no to a judge who does that. I think improv's terribly important for something like this. Right. And, okay, you just spellburned everything. That's cool. Yeah, this big bad, that's fine. So you guys just want to head back to your own little village and your tavern. Yeah, we're going to go drink and celebrate and spend our money. And okay, so the stuff that waylays you on the way back is going to be even more hurtful and more dangerous. And gee, don't you wish you still had some of your stats left so you could continue spellburning?
For me, as far as this has always been a huge problem in con games, what I do in my pre-gens is I don't give them very high luck scores. Sorry.
Yeah.
A con game, you know, you want to have fun or whatever. You already know what kind of player that is. Player that is that pre-gen before it ever was brought out to the table was a guy who was burning too much luck already anyway.
Yeah.
Right? Because
especially if they're past zero level, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That plays in a con game, right?
Yeah, right. I have no problem with
that's
that.
A great,
people
no,
can
that's
give me a
great
hard time, but I, as far as a con game, I just don't give really high luck scores to any of your PCs, really, because they can just use that for everything. You know, there's still the spell burn, so I usually just, honestly, I just roll up the stats as normal for the rest of it, so if they ended up with really high scores...
Yeah, Purple then, Sorcerer then is could, our friend.
Yeah, they can spell burn the hell out of that. Yeah.
I would say...
You might want to even nerf the wizards some of their spell burnable abilities, just give them... something. I've been con games where you spell burn the end and it's fun, and I've also been in con games where it's totally anticlimactic.
Yeah. Yep.
And you want everyone to have fun.
When I heard you say that, Job, I immediately said you're 100% right about luck. And honestly, there's no reason that any wizard at a con game needs to have agility, strength, or stamina over 8 or 9 either, you know? I mean...
It's not going to hurt the rest of their game, right? I mean, or give them a little bit of something. You know, you want them to be able to spell burn, but not give them 18 and everything, you know?
Hold them to 10 to 15 range instead of 15 to 25 range, right?
25?
Well, if you had all, you know, 10s to 15s in your stats, you could burn down to...
Gotcha.
Yeah? Yeah.
My math failed for a second. Sorry.
Basic tip of con games, and we won't have to explore every dimension of this, but it has a lot to do with spell selection too, right? Don't let these, you know, don't let these players have everything. You can control the abilities, you can control the spell selection. Go through patron spells very carefully, and maybe don't give them forest walk, where they're just going to be, you know, jumping from around from tree to tree the whole time, right? Some of that stuff is good. All the, you know, give them a good patron spell that's fun, but consider it carefully in the scenario you're doing. If it's sandboxy, moving around tree to tree might be just great. But if it's something where it's in one location, you know, you want them to interact with that location.
Well, hey, if they're going underground into a dungeon, let them go from tree to tree.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you could be the jerk and give their pre-gens forest walk when they're in a subterranean, you know, dark elf city or something.
Well, you can at least give him an extra spell and see. I gave you an extra patron spell, Forest Walk.
Yeah.
And then, well, and that's when they come walking in there with a potted tree sapling and a pot.
Exactly.
Okay, if you can find another one, we'll talk.
They bring two. It's like Portal in here.
One of the other things that really bugs me as a judge is that despite the best effort of the game and the spirit of DCC, we have monsters that are supposed to defy the normal player response of, oh, that's a such and such. We need to do this to kill it. You know, whether destroying by fire, decapitating it, or any other method. Players always seem to chat amongst themselves to see if they've ever fought anything like this in other games, especially when you're at a con, right? I think it's up to me to change things up for those players. You know, maybe take the inspiration of a monster. You know, if you're playing the one who watches from below and you come upon those harpies, they know how to avoid it or how to best kill them. But maybe I take away one of those powers and modify it to give the players a surprise. And that way they don't exactly know what is coming. That's one of the things that has bugged me about other games. I see a huge propensity among players to start doing the same thing with DCC stuff, especially if you're running something out of a module. And they sit down and they're like, yeah, I played this module before and I know how best to get through it. Guys, that's not cool. I think that's another thing that lies on the judge to kind of go with it on the fly and change things up a little bit so that it's also fun for the rest of that table.
Yeah.
And you don't have that one player doing all that.
Right. Bringing up that adventure, Jen, actually, you reminded me too, is another way to deal with the spell burn, massive spell burn at the end of the adventure is that that's not the end of the adventure. You have, I wrote it into the end kind of as an epilogue type of thing and the one who watches from below, but it's the, okay, now the temple's falling in on your head and the eyes are following you and you have to get out.
Good luck.
Yeah. So, but you know, in a lot of con games, if there's time left over, I'm like, okay, well, we got some time to kill. You guys have to get out and make them remember how to get out, but play through that.
When the heck do you have time left over in that one?
I never
that
have.
That would be tough.
I never
have. That one would be tough.
I will say that it's designed. So just define expectations, Jen, like you said, not just in, I mean, certainly in monsters and stuff, but also, you know, just in your adventure design, put the big bad in the first encounter instead of the last. And they'll be very scared to spell burn everything in the first encounter, right?
Yeah.
Or make them all freaking spell burnable type challenges. If they are walking and breezing through stuff, make them all harder. Certainly that might be the approach. So again, defy expectations by not just saving up the boss until the end of the adventure can be a way. Or, you know, you present the boss, they spell burn and they, you know, get that outrageous charm person, which has a saving throw target of 31 or whatever. And then your poor 5 stamina, 5 strength, 5 agility magic user watches as the mama dragon comes out and is like, oh no.
Yeah, you always have that. I mean, you could just throw in another monster at the end, but I don't know. It's kind of cheesy.
Well, you wouldn't want to do it every time, of course. Yeah. But
I like your idea of putting a really tough finale level tough monster in the middle of the adventure. It might be one way to kind of soak up some of those resources before the end.
Yeah, I know the making of the Ghost Ring does something similar.
Absolutely. Well, I did it a while back in a session I ran here, and it was kind of like they could meet the worst monster at the beginning or the middle or the end, depending on what they did, and they ended up meeting it in the first encounter before they actually got into the dungeon proper. And then they just annihilated it with like a critical spell check roll. Oh, it was so disappointing. Anyway,
yeah.
So they still just annihilated the thing anyway. But again, the dice, when the dice are hot for them, you know, so be it.
Oh, yeah. And those big rolls of charm and, you know, word of command, those are inevitably where I roll a 2 in response for the save. Right. So
monsters need to have really good saves because when you're spell burning, those spell check targets become like 25, 30, you know, I mean, they can get really high.
So, yeah, plus 15 is not going to help a 2.
Yeah, true.
So, Julian, you mentioned earlier in the show about the house rule you had about the permanent loss for Spellburn.
Well, just something I've been toying with, yeah. I mean, what do you guys think? Is that too harsh? I would say that'd be a feature of my campaign because I'd say, guys, because we start and end in a set, you know, in a kind of self-contained set piece, the Spellburn thing in the middle of the dungeon thing isn't as scary. So here's my rule. You know, this is going to make you think twice. You've always got a 5% chance of taking a big hint. You're unleashing crazy chaotic forces. And when you do that, you're taking a big risk.
Yeah. You could also even use some of the optional effects of mercurial magic, like that was included with the Peril on the Purple Planet box set. And you could throw those in on top of whatever effects those spells have. You know, even if a one isn't rolled, you know, maybe do a little secret percentile roll on your end and throw something else in. Going along with, you know, make it unexpected.
As I was going through all this stuff today and I was reading up, I mean, there are patron spellburn charts that I probably haven't used as much as I should. I think our writing team thought of a lot of this stuff. But one thing I find is, I won't say the judges are lazy. I mean, I'm not, you know, lazy, but it's hard to kind of keep all of this stuff integrated. Some of the nuance and subtleties of the game balance this stuff out. But when you're at the table, it's hard to have those things at your fingertips.
I agree that, you know, we should do things like reread things periodically, especially problem points that we might forget in the book.
Read your patron paint and your spellburn patron results for those wizards and elves who have patrons, because there's some less than pleasant stuff in there that is not going to be as fun as just like, oh, you know, I took a hit on my agility.
House rules are fine, but your players don't always know every single one of your house rules up front. So they're going to call you on it and say, hey, but in the book, this, you know, this right here. It could be a house rule, or it could just be that you've forgotten, because there's a lot to absorb here.
Yeah, there is.
And then as far as, you know, invoke patron and for the clerics, the divine aid, you're making bargains with otherworldly creatures. I don't see any problem using that to introduce complications for players who overuse spells and abilities.
I'm with you 100% on that.
You want divine aid? Okay, great. Like after the third time or whatever it is, okay, well now you have to do this particular thing for me. And it's not, yeah, I mean, this is more campaign play, but it's not something simple. Like that's actually going to turn into an adventure for you guys. It's going to inconvenience everyone. Everyone's going to have to go out and do something when, you know, be inconvenienced by this.
It's really a good point, because it's really important to the integration of the game, but you have to do that as a judge, right? You have to have that understanding of this is, it's not on a table and it's not in a page that you can look up in the index, but that is the balance of it. If you're calling on your patron all the time, the judge needs to inflict some pain in the ass on the wizard via the patron, right? Because you're calling on his power all the time. And that's the way it's supposed to work. I mean, but I wonder if everybody, you know, in the past, I probably have downplayed that a little bit. I'm going to really upplay that in my next session or two.
There we go.
So, you know, but you have to keep those things in mind, because if the mechanical balance is not baked into the game, it's the spirit of the rules that lives in.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I actually was thinking about that the other day, is that, you know, DCC asks a lot of the judge. And I think maybe that judges a lot of times kind of forget that it's their responsibility to put some checks and balances into the game. This isn't just an algorithm for you to roll dice on and spit out the results. You know, there's a lot of human judgment, you know, in the title. It's not called a dungeon master, it's called a judge, because we need you to, or, you know, Joe Goodman or the Goodman Games is asking you to, you know, use your mind to make judgment calls on this, you know, kind of freeform rule system.
Yeah.
You as a judge are the awesome responsibility of representing Appendix N is reposed within you. So you must act as a this solemn responsibility has been given to you. You must use your reason and your judgment to make sure they don't break the game, just with simple mechanics.
Yeah, let the dice fall where they may and come up with a way to make it interesting.
The other thing I wanted to touch on was bad guys, you know, especially in campaigns, have heard about the adventurers, know stuff about them, know their, you know the spells they have possibly, know their tactics, might know their patron. Smart opponents don't have to be played stupidly. Smart opponents also have smart tactics, and long-term opponents actually know stuff about how to, and will figure out how to counter characters.
Especially if they have a grudge or something.
Absolutely. So
I like
Don't shortchange your villains and your monsters who might be plotting and scheming. They wouldn't put a giant, intricate, multi-episode plan together and then not think about how to overcome the guy's charm person that always defeats all the monsters, right?
Right.
I think we've had a good discussion. And I think it's about time for us to move on to the end of our episode with Patron Bond.
Who are you?
Your new lord and master.
What orders from Mordor, my lord?
Oh, don't trouble. One thing I can't stand, it's people groveling.
Go ahead.
Patron Bond.
Back here in Patron Bond, we will evaluate how easy or hard it is to break the game with DCC. Considering balance, considering exploits, we'll award the game a critical hit, a hit, a miss, or a fumble. I'm going to put Job on the spot first.
I don't quite understand what I'm voting for, but I'm going to say for your player that this episode was a critical hit. You've got a lot of fuel to drive your judge crazy. You know, for the judges, it's probably just a hit. We're probably introducing some complications into their life, but hey, change is good, and you guys are going to have to roll with the program here. Sorry.
That's fair. Judge Jan?
Probably going to be in Job's corner for this one. You know, hey, there's a lot of things players can do, so bully for them. On our part, it might actually take a little bit of work, a little bit of reading the rules, and if we want to make house rules or exceptions, we should say so up front and be pretty comprehensive in, you know, what we think flies and what doesn't, like spending 1-0 level character's luck to boost another one's initiative. So
Yes.
A definite hit on the judge's end. I mean, if we're talking pleasure in running the game, then usually critical hit. But it all is based on the players at the table and the feel of the game. So, Julian?
Obviously, I love running the game, so it speaks for itself. I'd say the rules are a definitely hit. They have plenty for the player to utilize tactically. And there's just an enormous grab bag of stuff for the GM to use as a toolbox. I think the only thing it lacks, maybe, and even though there's plenty in there about making the game your own and setting up the rules the way you want and options to house rule, and we encourage you and understand you're going to house rule, there might be a little more emphasis up front for the newer judge to explain, you know, kind of think through the way that it is not a balanced game in that typical way, that you have to actually bring your creativity to balancing the math sometimes and, you know, work around some of those things that have cropped up. If that's something you learned, you're just getting in there and taking your lumps and running the game a bunch. And we've got great resources for that. So I think it's great. But I think it can be challenging for the newbies.
Fair enough.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, great. Well, I think that's a wrap. That was a great episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
And remember to contact us if you've got any feedback for us. Our mailbag's getting kind of slim. We're at theband@spellburn.com.
Thanks, everyone, and happy 2017.
Talk to you guys later.
Bye. See you then.
You've been listening to Spellburn, copyright 2016. Our theme music has been graciously provided by Glitter Wizard. You can hear more of their music at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com. Thanks for listening.